When I was a graduate student in physics at Harvard, I had pretensions to interest in philosophy. When I had conversations with a few professors there, they told me, if you really want to talk about the meaning of quantum theory and general relativity, you should go over to BU with John Stetch or Adam Shalomiar and talk to them. And I'm very honored that John is here. And Adam, I think, is not here, but it's a great presence of my mind coming here. And I used to come regularly to the Boston Collegiate for the philosophy of science as a student. And a lot of my education in philosophy of science came from hearing those talks. So it was a great honor to be asked to give one. Now, I'm going to have to ask for your help. And I think I can. No, that's wrong. That's wrong.
You're a graduate student, but that's what you do.
Good.
That's also a reason.
Okay, thank you. I'm fine. So, I also want to thank my fellow speakers for being on the program, especially the Burmani Baranga, who is sitting in the back, for whom this represents the report of a collaborative effort between a philosopher and a physicist going back now, I think, 7 years. In which we found, here's the riddle, in which we found a joint interest in the idea that the laws of nature evolved. And some years ago, at the start of our project, Roberto said to me, we met in his office, and Roberto said to me that you've written on the idea that laws evolve, and I will be talking about some of my work on evolving laws of physics. But we clearly never considered deeply the implications for our understanding of time and also the possibility of a contradiction, at least at first sight, between general relativity and quantum gravity, which is timeless, and where I had done work, in fact, on solving the timeless equations of quantum gravity, and the implications of the idea of the laws of nature evolve. So we began conversations, many conversations and collaboration, which are going to result in a book which will come out next fall, The Singular Universe and the Reality of Time with Roberto, and also some aspects of our collaboration have been reported in the popular book that Peter mentioned. Okay. Now, I'm very aware that I'm not a philosopher of science, I'm a scientist, and even though I am honored to talk to and with philosophers, my interest is really in the future of physics, and particularly with this question. We now know enough about the laws of nature. We don't have a complete unification. We don't know if that's even the right question to ask. But we know enough to ask the question of why are these the laws and not other laws? And my talk will be focused on this question. Along with the question of why these laws, there's the question of why these initial conditions. The more we know about the history of the universe, the more, said in the conventional language that we end up in a kind of paradoxical situation in which we have to speak of improbable initial conditions of the universe. If anybody here is following cosmology, the lesson from cosmology is not just that the universe has a history, but that given what might have been the initial conditions shortly after the quote Big Bang, the initial conditions are highly improbable, are highly constrained and highly special. You might ask about that, who ordered that, which is actually a quote from Aya Rabi responding to the discovery of the muon. Who ordered that? But we can say that about the standard model of particle physics and the standard model of cosmology. It applies to both the laws of the initial conditions. Now, of course, physicists began with the triumph of the two standard models of cosmology and particle physics, worrying about this, why these laws and why these initial conditions questions. Charles Peirce had worried about it a century before. And this is, I won't read all the quotes on my screens, but I'll read the first sentence. "To suppose universal laws of nature capable of being apprehended by the mind, yet having no reason for their special forms, but standing inexplicable and irrational, is hardly a justifiable position." And this question of, can we have rational explanation for, sufficient reason for, the choice of the laws and the choice of the initial conditions, are the questions that this work and this talk addresses. Now, we have not been able, we've been singularly unable to answer these questions about why these laws and why these initial conditions. Since the 1970s, we've been unable to further the project of unification. And consequently, it's fair to say, and many and more of my colleagues are saying it, that physics and cosmology are in a crisis. And the reason is our inability to answer these questions. There are many ideas and theories that theorists have contemplated since the 1970s, and I've spent my good time on some of these. But recently, we have the judgment of experiments, and experiments says all the work done by theoretical physicists and much done by theoretical cosmologists the last 40 years has been for naught, apparently. There's no proton decay. There's no evidence of further unification beyond the standard model. At the LHC, there's just a Higgs. There's no supersymmetry. There's no extra dimensions. The Planck satellite sees evidence for only the simplest possible model of inflation, if inflation is correct. And less noted, journalistically, but there have been experiments test, well, quantum gravity, which is my area, leads one to expect that there's maybe a discrete structure of the Planck scale that could be seen experimentally. One could probe to energies on the order of comparable to the Planck scale. And recently there is astrophysical data from Fermi and OJ that does that and tells us that there's no evidence of quantum gravity or quantum structure, discrete structure of space-time at the Planck scale. So, we clearly need to start over. We clearly need new ideas, new vantage points. There's some must be, theoretical physics has not had a comparable period since Galileo to be off the track compared to experiment for so long, and to have so much speculation work be conclusively shown by experiment to be off the track. And we need to understand what the mistake was and to make a different starting point. The claim of Roberto and I is that the mistake was the following. The mistake was following a methodology for research which is well adapted to discussing subsystems of the universe, small subsystems of the universe, and applying that to the universe as a whole. That paradigm I will be discussing in detail in a little while, we call it the Newtonian paradigm, and we'll be discussing why it is fallacious to apply it to cosmological questions. We then need a new kind of framework, a new kind of paradigm to apply to cosmological questions, to answer questions like why these laws, why these initial conditions. And our claim is that such a new beginning has to start by embracing the inclusive reality of time, and I'll be discussing what I mean by that shortly. Okay, so that's the provocation. Here's the philosophical version of the argument. The philosophical version of the argument is the mistake is deeply rooted in an error that those of us who call ourselves naturalists have made regarding the nature of time. A naturalist is somebody who believes that all that exists is the natural world, which is perceived but exists independently of our senses and whatever tools extend them. I take it most of us are naturalists, and if we're naturalists, we think that we look for truth in using science. It may not be the only method, but it's the best method we have. And there are traps. So what I would want to draw your attention to is that it's not enough to be a naturalist. There are traps to fall into, and a typical trap that I speak for myself has fallen into, and I think many of my colleagues fall into, is to make statements like, yes, we know about the natural world through our sensory impressions, but sensory impressions are illusions. They misrepresent the world in so many different ways. Beyond them is a natural world which is really X. And this can be an important step in a scientific program if X is a testable scientific hypothesis by really made of atoms. But if X is a metaphysical fantasy, like really a mathematical object, naturalism can easily turn into its opposite. That is, you find people who see themselves to be in the scientific tradition and are naturalists, trying to use science to further a kind of metaphysical fantasy. For example, that nature is really a mathematical object. And part of the burden of this talk and Roberto's talk is to examine that fallacy and put it right. Max Tegmark, I'm sorry Max isn't here, across from MIT, has a view that the whole world is a mathematical object, and this is just a little common thread. Sabina Hasenfelder is a professor at Nordita and a particle physicist. And this comes from our blog. Max Tegmark says the whole universe is a mathematical structure, so you must believe that he is a mathematical structure. And I am a mathematical structure too. I wonder what it feels like as being a mathematical structure. And that will turn out to be the right question. Okay. So we would like to underline that it's not enough to just declare that you're leading to naturalism. There are different, very different versions of naturalism depending on the view of time that you hold. There is the view that I think is prominent and dominant among my colleagues, which we can call timeless naturalism. It holds the experience of moments of time and their passage of flow or illusions. What really exists is the eternalist perspective. What really exists is the whole history of the universe as one object, taken as one. This is what is called in general relativity the block universe perspective. What really exists is not the flow of time. What really exists is not moments of time. What really exists is the whole solution, the whole mathematical object, which general relativity would represent as the solution of the Einstein equations, taken as one thing. That's what's real. And everything else is perspective. And I think Jenin is going to address this and set me right on this, or try to set me right on this, but I'm drawing a contrast here between this view and the view that I want to call temporal naturalism. Temporal naturalism holds that all that is real at a moment of time, which is one of the succession of moments. There are no timeless objects, there are no timeless truths, there are no timeless facts. The past consists of events or moments which have been real, but which are no longer real. There are facts of the matter, there are statements about the past that can be true or false. And some of those can be verified through present evidence. But there are no statements of fact, there are no facts that have truth values about the future. I'm going to skip because I have a lot to say, but Julian Barber has another view which fits somehow in between them. I'll come back to it if somebody wants to discuss. Now, among philosophers, which I admire but don't profess to be, there's a long debate between presentists and eternalists. And you might think that the argument that Roberto and I are making is just a rerun of that debate. And I want to emphasize that it's not. This may seem presumptuous, but we are not making a rerun, and we're not trying to make a move in the eternalist-presentist debate. And the reason is that our interest is the status of laws, which doesn't feature largely in most of the eternalist-presentist debates. So I want to now make a formal argument about laws of nature, and this is the core to our argument that the methodology of physics up to this time cannot be extended to address cosmological questions. What I'm going to do is outline a common structure or schema that we call the Newtonian paradigm, Newtonian schema, that applies commonly to Newtonian dynamics, field theory, quantum mechanics, general relativity, quantum field theory, string theory, quantum gravity, etc. And then critique it and argue that it only has empirical content. It only can make connections to experiment indicates that it's a description of the subsystem of the universe, and that the right empirical context for any theory in this framework is broken if we try to use it to apply to the universe as a whole and answer cosmological questions. So that's the logic of the core argument which follows. The key is the separation of explanation into two parts, laws and initial conditions. And what characterizes theories within the Newtonian paradigm is that there's separate data and there's no confusion ever between what's a statement of the law and what's a statement of the initial condition. To set up a theory in the Newtonian paradigm, therefore, you have to answer two questions. One, what are the possible states of the system? What are the possible configurations of the system in some fixed time? And it has to be a timeless answer for that. So, for example, this doesn't work like social theory or biology in which the possible states of the theory develop in time. And as the system becomes more complex and elaborated, new states, new possible states open up. So it does work for all the physical theory domain. Once you state what the possible states of the system are, you give a law of evolution that tells you how those states change in time. Okay. This formally is associated with a mathematical structure in which there's a space of states, the points at which are possible configurations of states of the system, possible preparations, possible initial conditions, possible confusion arguments, they're all the same thing. And the second question, the dynamics, is addressed by giving a rule that tells you if you're at one state at some time, what state will you be at the later time? And I'm sorry, I hope that's not too distracting. Formally, the path, the history of a system is represented by a curve in the space of states, which tells you how states evolve, and there's such a curve through every point, a single unique curve through every point. To apply this scheme to an experiment, an experimentalist prepares the system at some time, at some point, let's call it X, follows the system with a clock, which is, by the way, always external to the system, to a time T, and then predicts that the system will be at a state Y, and then checks to see if it's an important experiment. Something that never comes in is the notion of how. What time it is, what state it is right now, plays no role in the discussion. And the reason is that this is a formalism that is applied to systems in the past. If you want to discuss, does your theory agree, does your mathematical model agree with the experiment, you ask the experimentalist to make a series of observations, chart a trajectory on the space of states, and then you compare that with the predicted trajectory on the space of states. So the fact that the predicted trajectory is a mathematical object, a so-called timeless mathematical object. Can you all hear me? Is related to the fact that the records are also timeless. The connection between an experiment and theory is done by comparing theoretical predictions with records of experiments. The records of experiments having taken place in the past are frozen. They don't evolve in time. The predictions don't evolve in time. Both are, in different senses, timeless and real. But, I'm kind of ahead of myself a little bit. But there's no need to argue that nature somehow in some intrinsic way is timeless, as is often done, if not by people who know better, by colleagues, by various physicists, including good physicists like Julian Barber and Einstein and so forth. Now, the key move that brings trouble is to take this description of nature, the schema for description of nature, and apply it to the whole universe. As long as you're not applying it to the whole universe, there are no metaphysical troubles, there's no provocation, there's no temptation to think that the whole universe is a mathematical object, or the whole universe is isomorphic to a mathematical object. If you're just using the method to describe small subsets of the universe, we never aspire to extend to cosmology. There's no problem. The method fits the method of experiment and the comparison of physics theory experiment perfectly. Timeless naturalism, we want to argue, is the mistake that you made by taking the Newtonian paradigm and extending it to the universe as a whole. And I'll be arguing that in detail. Now, just analogy, sometimes people, like for example, my colleague Sean Carroll, like to talk about atomism and the importance of atomism. But atomism, atoms moving in the void, is a species, essentially, of the Newtonian paradigm. The image is that atoms, eternal and unchanging, move according to timeless laws in a void that also never changes. The void, if now you think we're modern, we have a dynamical space-time, the space-time really evolves in the space of configurations of the gravitational field, which is timeless. So there's a long tradition for this version of atoms, of the Newtonian paradigm. Okay. Now, some of which is on this slide I've said before, so let me just make a few points. As long as the proper use of the Newtonian paradigm is to describe small substances in the universe, where the measuring instruments, the experimentalists, the clock, are outside the system. For example, the fact that there's a whole space of possible initial conditions is related to the fact that the observer has the free choice of the initial conditions. There's a perfect match between the choice of the experimentalist to prepare the system in the laboratory, or the choice to select from a large number, say, of astronomical systems with a similar constituents. That choice exercised by the experimentalist is mirrored in the fact there's a space of initial conditions, and they're free to prescribe initial conditions experimentally and theoretically. And as I said before, the fact that the history of the system is represented by a curve in space by a mathematical object, which can be called timeless, in no way justifies the use of timeless to nature. What's timeless is the records that the experimenters have gathered that are compared with experiments. When you take the method outside the context of theories of small substances in the universe and apply it to the whole universe, all these connections between theory and experiment breaks down. There is just one system. There's no choice about the initial conditions. Usually, we use the freedom to vary the initial conditions to test hypotheses as to what the laws are. This, again, is the separation of the laws and the initial conditions. In cosmology, we can't do that. In cosmology, we test simultaneously hypotheses about initial conditions and hypotheses about what the laws were at the time. And this results in problems of underdetermination popping up all over the place in observational cosmology. For example, some observers some years ago, studying the cosmic microwave background, found what are called non-Gaussian energies. It doesn't matter what non-Gaussian energies. Stefan knows what non-Gaussian energies are. There was evidence for non-Gaussian energies. There's a structure that can be in the microwave background. Within days, tell me if I'm wrong, there were papers explaining this in terms of inflation by varying the initial conditions. There were also papers within the same days explaining the same observations by varying the laws that govern the inflationary expansion. There's a degeneracy or a problem of underdetermination because you are not able to vary the initial conditions to test hypotheses about the laws. So there are lots of ways, and I could spend the whole talk on this, and I won't, but if people want to question creating more examples, there are lots of examples that show how the application of the same paradigm of explanation to cosmology is resulting in problems for real research in cosmology. So we call, with Roberto, the extension of this method which applies to subsystems of the universe Newtonian paradigm or schema to cosmology, to the universe as a whole, a fallacy, because the relationship between experimental practice and theoretical practice breaks down. We call this the cosmological fallacy, to give it a name. What clearly is then needed is a new methodology, a new starting point, because we still want to do science at the level of cosmology, which does not live on a fallacy, and is not therefore guaranteed to fail. Now, there's a dilemma that follows the statement of the fallacy, which we call the cosmological dilemma, and that's the following. Any description of a subsystem of the universe through a theory of the form of the Newtonian paradigm is incomplete and must be an approximation. We know that. And we physicists refer to that all the time. We talk about effective theories, effective models, approximate theories. One reason that's true, there's several reasons that's true, but one reason that's true is that when we take a part of the universe and model it as if it were isolated from the rest of the universe, that isolation is approximate. Among other reasons that isolation is approximate, it's not just that the observers can't dig a hole deep enough and shield everything in the experiment. There are some forces, for example, the gravitational force and the influence of gravitational waves, which in principle cannot be shielded. That's, by the way, something that comes up from time to time. And there's a literature, a small literature of papers about it, but it's not well known. Gravitational waves in principle cannot be shielded. So the universe cannot be divided into isolated bits without approximations. Now we know that, and that usually causes no consternation, because we've always assumed that we can just scale up the method to include more and more stuff till we have the universe as a whole inside the description. But now we've understood that's fallacious. That the connection between experimental practice and theoretical practice falls apart when we try to scale it up. So we can't make a theory expressed in this language an exact description of nature. The kind of style of explanation which involves having a separate and varying distinction between laws and initial conditions and representing them both as mathematical objects and having the vision that the world is isomorphic to these mathematical objects is necessarily approximate on its own terms. We need a new methodology. This current methodology, the Newtonian paradigm, also fails because it has no solution, in principle, to the question of why these laws. The laws are initial conditions. I'm sorry. The laws are initial data which have to be stated to set up the description. The description can't tell you what its laws are supposed to be. It can't explain why there are these laws and not other laws. So the method is limited, it cannot address an important question which we would like to know the answer to. It also cannot address the question of why were these the initial conditions rather than other initial conditions. So, depending on the version of naturalism we want to endorse, we have a choice. We can endorse timeless naturalism, extend the Newtonian paradigm to the whole universe, keep the distinction between state and law absolute, keep the notion that laws are timeless and immutable, fixed. Have, by the way, this is something I don't have time to discuss, believe that the laws of nature are reversible in time. Have a ready invitation to the idea that the history of the universe is isomorphic to a mathematical object. That's great. That's a great paradigm that seduced many of us into science. But it necessarily stops working at this point. We're not going to get further. And it's evidence that we're not going to get further. Those who follow it unreflectively are driven where in the present period? We're driven to the multiverse. Why are we driven to the multiverse? We're driven by the multiverse because we're using a method which only applies cogently to subsystems of some larger system, when faced with the failure to ascend to God's mind, we would say, oh, well, the universe must be a subsystem of a bigger system, so we invent the fantasy of the multiverse. It's just a symptom that the methodology is breaking down. Or we can try out a new point of view, which we call temporal naturalism, and consider as hypotheses that the distinction between laws and states breaks down, that laws evolve, that there's nothing which is fixed and timeless, true for all time. All facts about nature are timed and tensed. I think I'm reading that correctly. No, maybe not. But are associated with the time. This opens up the possibility, as I'll now discuss, of explaining in a scientific context the answers to questions like why there's laws and why there's new conditions. Why does it open up a context where we can explain those things scientifically? Because we can make hypotheses about mechanisms that acted in the past to choose the laws and choose the initial conditions. And those hypotheses, since they're about the past, may have consequences for observation. So we have opening up before us, if we embrace the idea that time is real, in the sense that laws are not permanent, and laws can evolve, we have the possibility of a much greater empirical adequacy, with the possibility of answering the question that first set out, and I rather set out, more than that, of giving a reason for why these laws, as Peirce called for in 1893. And as Peirce said, the only possible way of accounting for laws of nature, this is a continuation of that quote, is if they are the result of evolution in time. But if laws evolve in time, then time cannot emerge from law, as many of us in quantum gravity have been trying to make happen these last, John, 50, 60 years. Playing with the idea that time emerges from some fundamental law of quantum gravity, the Liouville equation is 1964, something like that. If laws are not absolute, if laws change in time and evolve in time, then time must be prior to law. And indeed, causality must be prior to law. Something that I'll come to in a minute. So there is hope for a greater empirical adequacy of our theories by giving up the idea that our theories are about the discovery of timeless laws. This was hard for me to get used to, but now I'm sure that it's true. I'm having grown up as a theoretical physicist with the idea that the success of science and physics is based on the discovery of laws which are true outside of time and beyond time. It was hard to accept the view that view of time and law is a limitation on empirical adequacy, and to surpass that limitation we have to go over to a new way of thinking, which the laws evolve during time which is prior to the laws. But that's the case that we're making. Okay. I made very fond of Max Tegmark's views at the beginning, because I like Max, and I admire his stubbornness in maintaining an impossible position. But the idea that the universe, or the history of the universe, is isomorphic to a mathematical object, or indeed is a mathematical object, is untenable for two reasons. Once you sign on to this temporal naturalist point of view. One reason, because all I have to do to show that the world is not isomorphic to a mathematical object is show one property that the world has that no mathematical object has, and that one property is that it's always some present moment. If I don't try to get out of it by arguing that this present moment is an illusion, is a kind of mistake of perception, I believe that the present moment is real, then there's no mathematical object that has a property akin to there is always a present moment. So the world is not isomorphic. The world does not share all its properties with any non-tangible object. Secondly, if I believe there's nothing outside of nature, what are we doing saying that there's a non-tangible object that is isomorphic to the world? Either the non-tangible object is part of nature, in which case it's a sub-part of nature, in which case it can't be isomorphic to the whole, or the non-tangible object is outside of nature, in which case it doesn't exist, and we're talking about a fantasy. So the connection between mathematics and physics, while important and effective, is not complete. And this is a point I think Roberto will remind on. We need a new view of mathematics that puts that is not platonic and also not conventionalist, but puts mathematics as something which is inside of nature. Okay. Now, I have, by my clock here, 10 minutes or so?
Yes. 10 minutes and 10 minutes for discussion.
Okay. I might go 5 minutes more than that, but let's see how it goes. Okay. So now I'd like to discuss in more detail how the Wiley's Law question can be addressed within the framework of the proposal. One thing that this requires is that there be more time for, if we want to hypothesize methods. So as a physicist, the philosophical, reflective, critical part of the discussion gets me to this point. There must be mechanisms by which laws evolve in time. Then my work as a physicist takes over, and my job is to invent hypotheses as to mechanisms by which the laws might have evolved in time. And those hypotheses must be testable. Well, the one thing we know from observation is that the laws have not evolved in time up to redshifts of 5 or 6 when there are quasars and where the quasar absorption lies. So there's no reason to believe that laws are evolving in time in the present era of the universe. We need more time to go beyond the present era. So one thing which is almost mandatory if you're going to investigate hypotheses about the evolution of laws, and if the Big Bang not be the first moment of time, but be a transition from some previous era. Mm-hmm. Indeed, that accords with the best work in quantum gravity. Recently, there's a great deal of theoretical, it's an old idea that quantum effects in space-time would cause a bounce from a previous era, which would replace the cosmological singularity. But there's a lot of support for that from recent work in quantum cosmology and quantum gravity. So we take that on. Here's the first quote again, just to emphasize it. But Press was not the only one who speculated that the laws of nature might evolve in time. Paul Dirac speculated about the evolution of laws. Even Richard Feynman speculated, John Lewis speculated. And, however, our responsibility as scientists is not just to speculate as they did that the laws might have been different, but to put forward specific hypotheses for the evolution of those laws. And I'd like to briefly, very briefly, because I'm coming close to the end of my time, talk about two hypotheses among several that I've been investigating, one for a long time, one for a short time, about the evolution of laws. The first called cosmological natural selection, the second called the principle of precedence in quantum theory. And I'll discuss the second first since it's newer. Now, if we prepare and measure, imagine we prepare and measure a quantum system which we have studied many times before in history. So there's an ensemble of past instances of preparation, evolution, and experiment of this quantum system. Something that we know is true, or we believe is true, is that the outcome of the experiment could be selected randomly from the ensemble of past outcomes of the experiment. And that's true. Now, why conventionally is that true? Why conventionally? Because we believe that there's a timeless law, evolution under a Hamiltonian, unitary evolution under a Hamiltonian, which acts on the same initial state representing the preparation, and is challenged by the same operator making measurement, leading to the same probability distribution in the past as in the present. That's the conventional view. But that's a wild idea. from a metaphysical perspective or any perspective, what is this thing doing? A law acting timelessly on nature. And I could draw on that, but I won't do it in just a few minutes. So let me now point to that crucial sentence in red and point out that the sentence could be true even if we cross out those words. And now we read it to say, if we prepare and measure a quantum system we have studied many times in the past, the response will be randomly chosen from the ensemble of past instances of that preparation measurement. I want to propose that that is the only law of nature. Not as if it's the outcome is chosen from the ensemble of past instances, not because there's a timeless law which is acting in the present as it acted in the past, but simply because that is the law of nature. That systems of quantum systems, when challenged, look to an ensemble of past cases and pick one randomly and present it to the experimentalist. Now that has some presumptions and connotations which might be seem weird, but so does the idea of timeless laws acting in nature over and over again. It's just a different metaphysical presumption. There's a sentence without the crossing line. Now this is testable. I don't have time to go into why it's testable, but it's testable because in laboratories where people are playing with quantum computing devices, quantum communication, quantum cryptography, they're making systems of large, entangled states of large systems of degrees of freedom, many degrees of freedom, which have never been causally created naturally. So what they're doing in those laboratories while they're trying to build quantum computers is building systems which have no natural precedence. And if this view is right, those experiments shouldn't work. And we can talk, if somebody wants, I can talk about it, just not in the lab, but in a little more detail, some discussions with experimenters about how that might test that. Here, first was first. So this is a quote from first, which I didn't realize until after I published the paper about this. But first had the same idea for the first parents. Cosmological natural selection is an old idea. I'm going to skip it and go, if I can have 3 more minutes. If people want me to discuss cosmological natural selection, I can do so if people raise it. Because I want to discuss 2 objections which might be given to this view. Out of a list of 5 or 6 objections, I want to mention 2 of them, and I'll be happy to stop and have discussion. One of them is that this kind of view is inconsistent with the relativity of simultaneity. This is in response to an old argument, which is an argument that Hilary Putnam and I assume that somebody will know, that the relativity of simultaneity plus presentism implies determinism. The philosophers here will be aware of that argument. And it's an argument that can be brought against this point of view. And we have to fight it, in my view, and I think Roberto agrees, and accept a limitation on the relativity of simultaneity. That is, if we really want there to be an objective distinction between past, present, and future, within which laws evolve, it's very difficult to escape there being a global, universal, preferred notion of time which conflicts with the relativity of simultaneity. And I think rather than try to weasel out of that, we just have to bite that bullet. Very fortunately, there is a good reason to bite that bullet, which is a recent development in general relativity called shape dynamics. And I'd like to spend a minute to discuss it, because it's work of Julian Barber and a group of young collaborators the last 3 years. And let me say non-technically what shape dynamics does, and then for the relativists in the audience, I will say in 2 words technically what it does. Non-technically, what it does is the following. There is a gauge invariance, which means, I know that's not a technical word, there is a symmetry in general relativity under what's called many finger time, choosing the definition. You can see the general relativity as spaces with geometries evolving in time. But you can slice that space-time many different ways arbitrarily into slices of space evolving in time. And that freedom is called many finger time. What shape dynamics has taught us is that you can suppress that freedom, but investigate another freedom, which is invariance under local changes of scale. And since John Satcher is sitting here, I can emphasize that much of John's work is on the fact that gravitational degrees of freedom are the scale invariant conformal structure. And this is an elaboration of that idea. It rests on a similar body of results. So you can implement on the spatial manifold the symmetry that of invariance under local changes of scale rather than the symmetry under many finger time. And you can have a construction which formally is identical to general relativity, but has it the third notion of time in it. So one can take on board all the experimental evidence for general relativity and for special relativity and still believe in the physical picture in which there is a preferred, physically preferred, and relationally dynamically specified notion of time. And that's an important thing to rest on. Now, just a word, a word technically. Take general relativity, this is just to the experts. Take the Hamiltonian constraint, gauge fix it with a constant mean curvature condition, and then you have a second class system. But you can turn it around and take the constant mean curvature condition and consider it not as a gauge fixing, but as a generator of a symmetry that generates local scale transformations. And you consider the Hamiltonian constraint as its gauge fixing. Now you can prove that this duality between these two ways of introducing a gauge symmetry in the spatial dynamics of a spatial manifold, I'm the only way to do it. But that was a little aside for the experts. In any case, a notion of global time is good for the problems in quantum mechanics because we're now challenged to go beyond quantum mechanics. If quantum mechanics is a representative of the Newtonian paradigm, and the Newtonian paradigm breaks down for cosmology, there cannot be a quantum theory of cosmology. So quantum mechanics must embed in some larger theory, and most attempts to embed quantum mechanics in a larger theory require a preferred time. And there's a theorem by Anton Valentini to that effect. Okay, this is all I said. The last point. Somebody will raise, so I'll raise it for you in just 2 minutes on it, and I'm done. The metal law dilemma. If laws evolve in time, is there a law by which those laws evolve? And if there is, are we not subject to the same objections, the same problems? Or if there's not, isn't that a limitation of the reach of rational understanding? This is the metal law dilemma as we formulated it today. Our view, after staring at it for 6 or 7 years, is that this is one of those dilemmas which is productive. That is, it can be resolved because one can make hypotheses about the evolution of laws which are testable and have empirical content, which are not of the form of there's some space of laws in which there's a law which evolves and so you're right back to the same thing. And this, again, we can address in the discussion. But there are 4 distinct ways to try to make progress addressing this dilemma, and therefore, this is a solvable dilemma, we believe. And I will close, there's much more to say, but I will close with the statement that cosmology, the claim, in the rest of this century, is, we believe, going to be characterized by 2 things. One of them is the investigation of hypotheses about the evolution of laws, about what we place in quantum mechanics at a cosmological scale, about whether irreversibility is built into the fundamental laws because it depends if time is real, it becomes possible to contemplate that the fundamental laws are irreversible. So there is an empirical agenda to go forward on to see is this point of view fruitful for science. It's not just the debate between fixed philosophical position. It's a proposal of agenda for science which will prove itself on the basis of its success or failure empirically. Thank you very much. Why don't you start and I'll see.
All right.
Since you
know
your
words. Well, go ahead.
I'd like to have you consider something which I think you implicitly were dealing with here, but the word brain never occurred. You're talking about how human beings and brains do things, form laws, evolve. The understanding of all these things depends upon how
Mary, thank you, sir. I understand your question. And in the 3-hour version of this talk, there's a whole section on
Qualia. I know
you
do deal with this, but it doesn't appear in this
talk. It doesn't appear in this talk. And there is a relationship, or an analogy at least, between the problem of Qualia and the problem of the role of the now or the status of the now. And I do deal with it very gingerly and very preliminarily, and because it's very preliminary, it's not in this formal talk. But I'm aware of that. Thank you.
John?
There are two respects in which general opinion public can wonder a great similarity and one with a big distinction. The great similarity is that processes are primary and secondary. And they quote a well-known physicist, relativity theory and quantum theory each tell us, no better, they scream at us, that our world is a history of processes. Motion and change are primary. Nothing is except in a very approximate and temporary sense. How something is or what its state is an illusion. It may be a useful illusion for some purposes, but if you want to think fundamentally without insight of the essential fact that is an illusion. Now that's supposed to be smaller than quoting. So I'd like to know why you change your viewpoint so much. It seems to me that if you accept the process point of view, which I do, this implies, when you apply it to relativity, for example, or even to quantity, that the four-dimensional description of any process is the only invariant one. Whereas it's break up into a sequence of instantaneous states parameterized by a global time variable depends on the definition of such a global time variable, which is not unique and may not even be possible. There are metrics losing to Einstein's equation, which is that I'm locally static, but globally stationary, and there is no universal context in any given state. Of course, the local time is only meaningful, that's the proper time. And I'm afraid there's a confusion between the local time, which is meaningful and path-dependent, and a global time, which could be defined linearly, but have no meaningful physical consequences. But the second way in which the two theories differ, and I think this is most important, because it's different between closed versus open systems. As you point out, general relativity can be treated formally, at least, as a global deterministic system, the block universe. Don't have to do that, of course, because any realistic system you treat is always a finite system, and that's an open system. And a closed system, the key concept is determinism, and the human consequence of that is fatalism. You can't do anything about it, as you pointed out. The open system, key concept of causality, control, and the fact is that we do have control over open systems. And your initial condition formulation does not hold for open systems. Even the simplest example, skipping rope. It's not enough to use the initial state of the rope. I have to tell you what the two people holding the end of the rope do in the course of time. That's where new information is fed in, and the system is causal if you know what the initial state was and what each holding each end of the rope does. Then you can tell what's going to happen in the future. But initial conditions is never enough for open systems. So you must distinguish between open systems and closed systems.
We're short on time. Does that respond? Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.
I just wanted to say one thing. Can you assume that the whole universe can be treated as a closed system? Well, you know, for example, from the Bond of Oil point of view, the space in the universe, and even you want to treat the whole universe, you can treat that as an open system too. There's no reason to assume that the universe,
Okay, John, you said so much, and let me just respond briefly. My view, for the first point, my view has not changed so much. I'm sorry it seems so. the formulation that I gave is that what's real is real. Anything real is real in a moment of time, which is one of a succession of moments. And our view with Roberto is that causal processes responsible for that succession are real and are primary. And the reality, when we say we are asserting the reality of time, we're asserting the reality of time as a process which forever is bringing the new out of the present. So I'm with you on the primacy of processes. I'm not with you on the view that a belief in the primacy of processes leads to the block universe perspective, leads to the four-dimensional perspective.
No, I'm saying it doesn't, because you simply deal with a closed system. If you deal with an open system, you can't break up the process, that's the whole point. You don't deal with the process as a whole.
I think this is a discussion, this is a subtle point, and it's well appreciated, but...
Is it very short? Very short. Okay. All right.
The Scorpions started 54 years ago, as we said at the beginning. Were we here, sitting and listening to your talk then, the question on the table would be, why is there more matter than antimatter? And along come CP violations of the weak interactions, and we answer the question. Yes?
Sure. That's why I didn't raise that as one of the questions about the initial conditions.
So, the question is now... could be answered later on if somebody has the brains like mine where and so on and so forth come up with CP violation of weak interactions. Doesn't mean it isn't possible you can answer it as normal science. What you're talking about here, there's a word for it. It's called cataphysics. You know the word?
No.
You should learn about it and read about it from Alpha Generi. Cataphysics is the metaphysics. What metaphysics is the physics. But anyway, I never addressed a specific question that bothers you other than the initial conditions.
And the choice of the laws. And look, that was one success, the issue of understanding matter over antimatter. For me, the situation has to be faced on that my generation and the generation older than me's task was to further unify physics past the standard models given to us in 1973. And every idea that we have put forward to do that have failed to make contact with experiment, first of all, or been refuted by experiment. Second of all, the idea that the answer to the question of why these laws is that there's a unique unification of the interactions we know about with gravity, with quantum theory, has been definitively shown to be false by the landscape of perturbative string theory. So we live in the wake of the failure of the methodology you're proposing, and my view is that has to be dealt with. Now, as far as the character of this discourse, I don't know what pataphysics is. It sounds like it was meant to be demeaning, but Roberto and I would like to propose that this discourse be considered natural philosophy.
It's not meant to be demeaning. It's humorous because it's Alfred Jarry. Yeah. But the point is that he said that sciences of the general, in many cases we have. And of course, the universe is the one. So you can't call the subject of human cosmology the way you're talking about outside of science. It's something else. And he went beyond metaphysics to call it pataphysics.
I think my whole talk and Roberto's talk is a response to your comments. So thank you.
So we will get to that. Let's thank Lee Smolin again.